Welcome to the Flood Church Sermon Podcast, where we bring you sermons from our teaching team at Flood Church, Lilongwe, Malawi. For more information, you can go to floodchurch.com.
So if you guys would stand, we're going to read from our passage. It's in Genesis chapter 50. And it is the whole chapter, verses 1 through 26. So it says, Joseph threw himself upon his father and wept over him and kissed him. Then Joseph directed the physicians in his service to embalm his father Israel. So the physicians embalmed him, taking a full 40 days, for that was the time required for embalming. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. When the days of mourning had passed, Joseph said to Pharaoh's court, If I have found favor in your eyes, speak to Pharaoh for me. Tell him, my father made me swear an oath and said, I am about to die. Bury me in a tomb I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. Now let me go and bury my father. Then I will return. Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as he made you swear to do. So Joseph went up to bury his father. All Pharaoh's officials accompanied him, the dignitaries of his court, and all the dignitaries of Egypt, besides all the members of Joseph's household and his brothers and those belonging to his father's household. Only their children and their flocks and herds were left in Goshen. Chariots and horsemen also went up with him. It was a very large company. When they reached the threshing floor of Etah near the Jordan, they lamented loudly and bitterly. And there Joseph observed a seven-day period of mourning for his father. When the Canaanites who lived there saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Etah, they said, The Egyptians are holding a solemn ceremony of mourning. And that is why that place near the Jordan is called Abel Mizraim. So Jacob's sons did as he had commanded them. They carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in a cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which Abraham had bought as a burial place for Ephron the Hittite, along with the field. After burying his father, Joseph returned to Egypt together with his brothers and all the others who had gone with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs that we did to him? So they sent word to Joseph saying, Your father left these instructions before he died. That is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive their sins. The sins of the servants of God, of your father. When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. We are your slaves, they said. But Joseph said to them, Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. Verse 22. Joseph stayed in Egypt along with all of his father's family. He lived 110 years and saw the third generation of Ephraim's children. Also the children of Machir, son of Manasseh. They were placed at birth on Joseph's knee. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you out of this land to the land that he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place. So Joseph died at the age of 110, and after they embalmed him, and he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. Please be seated. Wow. Who here would say that you have a, a good relationship with the close members of your family, your brothers, your sisters, your father, mother, your wife or husband. You know, put your hand up if you would say, yeah, I get along with all of them very well. We not only love each other because we're family, but we like each other. Yeah, so today, you know, we'll be talking a lot about family and the resentment that can be stirred up within families. Just a side note, I think it's fascinating in verse 2 and 3, you know, the way that the process of the funeral takes place. For 40 days, they go through this embalming process. For 30 more days on top of that, they continue mourning. And then after that, they actually do the, you know, a 7-day, Joseph took 7 days from his work with Pharaoh to go and actually bury his father. A 77-day period, you know, of mourning before the burial even took place. You know, here in Malawi, it's a bit different from American culture. In America, it's very common for people to have a funeral over your lunch break. And so, you know, because of whatever, you know, like the idol of the American culture, maybe of just work or, you know, just being productive, being busy, being individualistic, whatever it might be, to make it convenient so that people don't have to take any time off work, they have a funeral over the lunch break so that you leave your work, you go to the funeral really quick, say, I'm so sorry, and then you go back to work again. And so coming to Malawi, you know, sometimes we'll get requests at the ministry for 3, 4, 5 days off of work for a funeral. And I'm like, what? You know, it seems kind of crazy to me, but compared to Egypt, you guys are like way under, you know. So, yeah, I think it's really cool, you know. I think that America could learn something from the culture of Malawi to really value, you know, and honor those who have died, you know, honoring their life. So, you guys have taught me that for sure. But, yeah, let me just say that, you know, coming back to the family topic, Satan loves it when families get torn apart. He's so passionate about seeing family members fighting with each other, you know, and hurting one another. But on the other hand, the Lord delights when families live in unity with each other. And we see that in Psalms chapter 133, verse 1. It says, how wonderful and pleasant it is when brothers live together in harmony. It's one of my favorite things, actually, about my wife. They are an incredibly close family. They communicate pretty much on a daily basis with all of our siblings. It's amazing how close they are and how much they like each other and love each other, you know? It's like they're good friends. It's amazing. For me, I'll go, you know, sometimes weeks and months without talking to, you know, I have three brothers. And so it's not at all uncommon for us to, you know, go an extended period of time without talking. We're not really that close. I remember back when I was just graduating from high school. It was 2006. It was my last year of secondary school. And I have two older brothers than me and one younger brother. And so the one in between the firstborn and me, I'm the thirdborn, he was getting married. And pretty much just to summarize the story, in the process of them, you know, getting married and kind of, you know, separating from our family, they pretty much approached my parents and started pointing out all these flaws that they have, you know, especially my brother. And he just kind of started saying, you know, as you were raising us, you failed me in this way and this way, and you hurt me like this. And they just kind of, like, demanded, you know, this apology from them. Like, you need to apologize because I'm now hurt and I'm now sinning in all these ways because of the way that you've hurt me growing up. And it kind of put my parents, like, in this corner. And it was really hard for them to respond lovingly. They got, you know, kind of defensive and they just said, man, we did the best that we could. You know, growing up, and sure, we weren't perfect. But it's just hard when you're, you know, when you're told that the job that you did was horrible, you know. It's not an easy thing to hear. And so, again, just, you know, long story short, it ended up just creating a huge division in my family in 2006, to where that brother didn't talk to my parents for about 3 or 4 years, and or maybe even longer than that. They have now 3 children, but it was about 4 years before my parents even saw their grandchild, I believe, for the first time. And eventually it got to the point where my brother just said, you know, maybe we can just kind of overlook a few of these hurts just for the sake of having our children have their grandparents in their life, you know. And so even to this day, over 10 years later, they still only see each other maybe once or twice a year just for the sake of, you know, formalities, maybe for Christmas or just something very briefly, just so that the kids can see their grandparents. And then on top of that, my other 2 brothers totally rejected that brother from our family. They actually, instead of calling him by our last name, they called him by the last name of his wife and said, he's that family now, he's not our family. And their firstborn is 8 years old. And my 2 brothers that rejected that other brother met their niece, the firstborn, who's 8, for the first time when she was 6 years old at my wife and I's wedding reception. For the first time, they saw their niece and their 2 nephews. Whew. So, yeah, that's why this topic of resentment among families is, you know, a bit close to home for me. But I'd love to just go through 2 or 3 verses in Genesis chapter 37, just to get a little bit of background. Humphrey's actually already preached a message on this passage in Genesis 37, but I just wanted to quickly highlight a couple verses here, just to kind of see, you know, a little bit of the background of what happened in Joseph's life between him and his brothers. So, in Genesis chapter 37, verse 2, it says that Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flock with his brothers, the son of Bilhah and the son of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. And so here's kind of the first verse where we see that Joseph, as a 17-year-old, as they're tending the flock, you know, together with his brothers, I don't know what they did, if they did something or if they just said something, but whatever it was, Joseph didn't like it. He's like, my brother shouldn't do this, or they shouldn't say this. And so he took that issue to their father and said, you know, he said this or they did this. And then I'm assuming that the father then went to them and said, you know, you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't say this or Joseph told me this. So it started building up this resentment between Joseph's brothers and Joseph. They resented the fact that he went to their father and ratted them out and tattletaled. And so it's kind of this beginning, you know, of resentment building between Joseph's brothers and Joseph. And then if we jump to verse 10 in the same chapter, we see this dream that Joseph has, and he vocalizes it to his parents and to his brothers. And so in verse 10, you know, it just says, when he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. And so again, we kind of see, you know, more resentment growing. That is, Joseph has these dreams. He shares it with his family, and they resent the fact that he thinks he's better than us. He thinks that we're going to actually bow down before him. So it's just stirring up more of this resentment. So something fascinating about resentment is that, you know, it commonly starts just with seemingly very minor things. And resentment is rarely just one-sided, where one side is just constantly only hurting the other side. But usually, you know, Joseph first did an act of resentment toward his brothers that made his brothers resentful by, you know, going to his father and telling them what it is that they were doing or saying. And so, you know, that one small act stirred up resentment of the brothers. And then the brothers took it the next step, and it just always increases. When it starts small, it slowly grows. And so, of course, it eventually, you know, grows to them throwing him into a cistern and then pulling him out of that cistern and selling him into slavery. You know, just that growing resentment between the two. Another crazy thing about resentment is that it gives us this false sense of justification. And so if someone does something that hurts us, it makes us believe this lie that it's okay to do something to hurt them back. It gives us a false sense of justification. I'm justified to go and hurt them. I'm justified to go and talk negatively about them. We get this false sense of justification. You know, a feeling that, oh, it's okay to do something bad to hurt them back. Sometimes, you know, I heard this story, a testimony in church. You know, someone got onto a minibus, and so they're up in front of the church telling the story. And they said, yeah, the minibus driver, he was so rude. And so I'm riding in his minibus, and he overlooked me. You know, he got payments from everyone else, but he didn't get it from me. So I got off the minibus. I was like, woo, you know, like, God showed me favor. He made me not, like, he gave me an opportunity to not have to pay for my minibus ride because the guy was rude, you know. And so, yeah, sometimes we get this justification in our resentments. And we can even, you know, like, give God the glory for this false sense of justification to allow us to do something wrong. Like, the Bible clearly says that we're to pay someone when we owe them something in Romans, you know? And so that's dishonest. The right thing to do would be to get off the minibus and say, hey, excuse me, you didn't get my payment yet. Here you go. Have a nice day. Woo! Wow. Yeah, and that's the way that the Lord can bless you, you know, when he sees that honesty in your heart and that integrity. He doesn't bless you by getting away with 300 kwacha that you should have paid to someone. Ooh. But yeah, we see this in kids all the time, you know. They'll be fighting. It's like, why did you hit your brother? It's like, well, you started it, you know. He hit me first. And so that resentment, you treated me unjustly. You shouldn't have hit me. I'm going to hit you back. You know, we see it in us as humans from a very young age. So yeah, I would love to just help, you know, save us all a lot of wasted time, a lot of wasted heartache. And just acknowledge the reality that that's a lie. That the reality that, you know, nothing apart from Jesus will ever justify us to do anything, you know, that's evil, that's wrong. Like, Jesus is the only thing that when we've sinned, we can come before him and receive forgiveness and be justified. You know, you may have heard justified. It's like just as if I had never sinned. You know, that's kind of like the meaning of being justified. So when we stand before heaven on the day of judgment, you know, he'll say, you're welcome to come into heaven. You believed in Jesus and he justified you. Woo! Man, I'm going to invite you into this place of perfection where only perfection dwells, and you're going to be received just as if you have never sinned into this place of perfection. Wow! So yeah, Jesus is the only thing that can ever leave us justified. No matter what anyone else does to you, no matter how bad it was, no matter how much it hurt, it can never leave you justified to do something, to do an act of evil, do an act of hatred. I love the way that Paul in 1 Timothy, you know, chapter 1, verse 15, he just says, here is a trustworthy saying that deserves full acceptance. Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. And so we see this fascinating, you know, heart position that Paul has, where he wholeheartedly believes he's the worst of all sinners. And it's just so powerful when you have a perspective like that, because it just gives Jesus a certain incredibly powerful place in your heart to be this very unique Savior, where he can totally save all of you. You know, if there's a place in your heart where you feel justified in the evil and the sins that you've done, then how can Jesus come and offer you forgiveness for that sin that you've done? It's like you're holding on to it. It's like, oh, I don't need forgiveness for this sin. Like, I was justified to do this evil thing. And it actually puts a barrier between you and Jesus. You say, no, I'm good. I don't need saving in this area of my life. I'm cool. But you can save me over here. Again, another powerful verse is in 1 Samuel chapter 24, verses 12 and 13. And David, I believe this is the context of him speaking with Saul, as Saul is hunting him down, trying to take his life. It's definitely a situation that, again, obviously David has the right to be incredibly resentful and incredibly bitter towards Saul. But these are the words towards Saul. He says, "May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs that you have done to me." And he says, "From evildoers come evil deeds, so my hand will not touch you." Wow. And so again, if you have some resentment in your heart, if there are some broken relationships in your family, if, you know, people close to you have done things that have hurt you, and you have this bitterness because you've been treated unfairly, one of the ways that we can release this resentment from our hearts is to put God on the throne as being the only one who can avenge wrongdoing. Say, "This is not my job." When we think that it's our responsibility to be vengeful, to return a hurt for a hurt, then we're trying to play the role of God. We're saying, "God, I don't trust you. I don't believe that you will actually be just in this situation. So I am going to do your job for you and make sure that this person hurts for the hurt that they've caused me." Rather than taking a step back and say, "God, I know that you're the one that avenges. Whew. So as for me, I won't lay a hand on them." Man. I love this quote from Martin Luther King. You know, obviously, he played a large role in helping to bring, you know, civil rights into America. Again, African Americans in America were being treated outrageously, unjustly. And so he has this quote, and he says, "Hate begets hate. Violence begets violence." And so "begets," again, is a kind of another kind of confusing word. But it just means it reproduces, or it brings more hate into the world. So when you hate, more hate is brought into the world. When we act violently, more violence is brought into the world. He says the ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, begetting the very thing that it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Woo! We must meet the forces of hate with the power of love. Isn't that beautiful? So again, we see Joseph setting an outrageously incredible example for us. I think it could have been so easy when his brothers approach him and say, "We're your slaves, you know, just don't kill us. Like, we'll serve you until we die. We know that we did horrible things to you. You know, just please forgive us." And they use their dead father's voice. They put words in his mouth and say, "Your dad, you know, who you love and he loves you, like he told you in this letter that we wrote, you know, that you need to forgive us." Joseph could have easily been like, "Hey, you know what? I love you. You know, sure, you did some horrible things to me. I won't make you my slaves, but just, you know, get out of my sight. I don't want to be anywhere near you." You know, he could have held on to that resentment. And there could have been this illusion of peace, right? Where they're living at a distance away from each other, but there's no true friendship. There's no true liking, you know, loving within the family. Just like, yeah, we're just kind of neutral. And so we see this, you know, in verses 15 to 19. A lot of chapter 15 is just a lot of details, you know, the first 15 verses. So I'm going to kind of skip over a lot of that, if that's cool. But yeah, let me just jump to verse 15. It says, "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back all the wrongs that we did to him?' So they sent word to Joseph saying, 'Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs that they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of your servants. of God, of the God of your father. When their message came to him, Joseph wept. And then 18, his brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. We are your slaves, they said. Verse 19, but Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? How did Joseph get so smart? It's incredible. You know, he just grasped this truth that I think is so rare, honestly, for the majority of humanity, even the majority of Christians, to really understand. You know, just that reality that, no, who am I to play the role of God? You know, for me to take revenge on you for the things that you've done to me. So some of you, you know, maybe you would say, you know what, David, my family's not that bad. Like, we don't fight with each other. You know, we don't scream at each other. Sure, there's been some hurts, but we're just kind of neutral. You know, they kind of do their thing. We're over here. We do our thing. And yeah, we love each other. But yeah, there's not real friendship there. You know, there's not that liking that you're talking about. I just love that, you know, being married to a Kenyan, she gives me a lot of kind of a perspective into Kenyan culture. I think some of it translates into, you know, Malawian culture. And, you know, just in the observations of one another's cultures, as, you know, she's met my family in America. She's like, yeah, it's so interesting that, you know, Americans tend to just feel so, they kind of feel like entitled to just vocalize their opinion, you know? And you guys speak out against Trump all the time, you know? Like, it's just kind of scary, you know? Like, in Africa, we tend to not do that. You know, in Kenya, you know, I think in Malawi, there's kind of more of this culture of silence where it's like, if someone did wrong to me, I'll just kind of keep it to myself. You know, I won't really go to them and vocalize it. How dare you did this to me? You know, just kind of like, I'll just deal with it. And, you know, sure, I'll keep the resentment in my heart. But on the face value of things, things look fine between us. When I see them, I greet them and, you know, pretend like everything's perfect. But deep down, there's no true peace between us. In, you know, this topic of war and peace among nations, it's fascinating that a mark of true peace between two warring nations that were once fighting with one another, it's not just a matter of the war has ended and there's no more killing between them. That's not what true peace looks like in the definition of two nations that are at peace with one another. A mark of true peace, when you say, yes, these two nations have gone from being at war with one another to actually being at peace with one another, is when those two countries start to work together and build up one another and partner together to say, yes, I want to do business with you. I want your economy to be strengthened by my economy as I purchase your goods, and hopefully you'll do the same for me. Like, let's work together. That's the mark of true peace. It's not just that they're not fighting anymore. It's not just that it looks like that they don't hate each other anymore. Isn't that beautiful? So there's just this powerful truth, you know, that peace, that love, that resentment being completely ridded from our hearts is not just a matter of passivity, right? I'm not just going to passively be okay with someone. But there's an element of activity. In this book called Jesus for President, he says that God dislikes both violence and passivity. And so as animals, you know, you've heard about this fight or flight response, right? And so when an animal is in a situation where maybe there's a bigger animal that's trying to attack that animal, you know, and in its fear, it has two responses. One, it can fight back and say, yeah, I think I can take this animal, you know, like, let me try to kill it so that it doesn't kill me. Or it's like, whoa, this thing is way bigger than me. I'm going to get out of here. I see this all the time with our cat. We call her Funa in Bonella. And when a lizard shows up, she's like, and she runs, like, you know, jumps on it and eats the whole lizard. Our cat eats a lot of lizards. Yeah. And so the lizard's like, oh my gosh, you know, like, I gotta get out of here. So that's a fight or flight response. Like, can I attack this cat? Can I? No, I don't think so. I'm gonna get out of here. But the beautiful thing about humanity is that we're different, you know, from animals. One of the ways that we are different from animals is that God has provided us with a third response. Instead of fight, instead of flight, He gives us this ability to actually stay in a situation and overcome evil with an active love. We don't have to fight back in violence. We don't have to just run away and be passive, safely at a distance, pretending like we're at peace with the cat that's trying to eat us. It's like, yeah, we're cool. That's cool. But we can actually counter evil with an active love. You know, we see this in Romans 12, where it just says, don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. It's one of my favorite verses in the Bible. So what would that look like for you? Now, what does it look like to counter evil, to counter resentment, to counter something that someone has done to you that was unfair, that was unjust, that stirred up all this hate, all this hurt inside of you? What would that look like for you to say, you know what, I'm not just going to passively sit by and pretend like things are okay. I'm going to actively seek to resolve and reconcile this relationship. Whew. Whew. Everyone take a deep breath. You know, one of the most important lessons, I think, in the whole Bible is found, you know, here in verse 20. I'm sure, you know, many of you have heard this verse before. You know, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done. I think we can learn a lot from this verse. You know, if it's not enough, you know, in your mind to think, okay, sure, you know, I don't want to play the role of God. I don't want to take vengeance. So yeah, maybe I'll just passively sit by and just say, God will handle it. You know, if you think like, you know, that's the only solution. Here is another perspective that you can have. You can actually go this extra step and say, you know what, I'm going to actively embrace what happens, you know, and I'm going to actively pursue reconciliation and say, you know what, you may have meant this to hurt me, but God meant this to actually be good and to actually bring about the saving of many lives. So when we go through things that would stir up resentment inside of us, when we are hurt by the hand of those who are closest to us, those who are even our own family members, we not only can let go of that vengeful feeling and release the bitterness, but we can actually say, you know what? God is able to use this. God can work all things together for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And even though this hurt me a whole lot, I'm going to let God deal with the resentment. I'm going to let this just, you know, slowly seep out of my heart and leave me. And I'm actually going to say, God, show me how, what happened in this situation. All this pain, all this hurt that I felt, show me how you can use it to help other people. Because definitely, sometimes our greatest sense of purpose can come out of our greatest pain. And we can say, yeah, you know what? My parents, they went through a divorce. It was painful. My dad wasn't around. But you know what? God can use this. I'm going to go and help other people that are going through, you know, the same situation that I went through that was so painful for me. Because I was alone in that, and it was so painful, and I don't want other people to feel that pain. You know, and God can use that, those feelings of resentment, to create so much good in your life and in other people's lives. And so it's just an incredible and beautiful perspective that we learn from what Joseph says here in Genesis 50. Come on. I know it's intense. Give me a smile just for a little bit. Because, yeah, in my family, you know, there is this open, festering, rotting wound for 10 years. We've all just been perpetually in pain by it, by what's happened, that our family has totally been fractured and divided and broken apart. And even after 10 years, the wound hasn't healed yet. But to have the perspective that God can use this pain, I don't have to return violence for the hurt that was done to me, and God can use this painful situation. My favorite verse in this passage, in chapter 50, is verse 22. And it says, Joseph stayed in Egypt along with all of his father's family. He lived 110 years and saw the third generation of Ephraim's children. Also, the children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were placed at birth on Joseph's knee. Man. See, that's what activity does. Not just passively you know, pretending like there's peace. Joseph actively stayed in the lives of his brothers. And that phrase, I looked it up, where it says those sons were placed on Joseph's knee at birth, meant that he actually took them into his own household and raised them as his own children. And just to think, you know, of a hope and a future that my family could one day go back to this, you know, where all of my brothers could be in the same room and they could be seeing each other's nieces and nephews on the day of their birth. It's incredibly powerful for me and incredibly hopeful. And if letting go of hurt and resentment, you know, can lead to this, then it's so worth it. And so just kind of as I come, you know, to a close, I just want to point to the life of Jesus, you know, and see that we can learn these same principles from him in his life as, you know, humanity. Definitely we sin against him on a daily basis, on a secondly basis. You know, we hurt him. We treat him unjustly. And he has every right to be resentful, to hold on to this bitterness because of the unjust treatment that we show to him regularly. But what does he do? What's his response? As he's in heaven and he's hanging out with God and he's talking, he's like, man, what should we do about this? It's like, oh, I got an idea. How about I go into the world and I live among them? Even though I know that they're still going to hate me and they're actually going to kill me, I'm going to put myself in the line of danger for their sake. I'm going to actively overcome this evil with love. In 1 John 3:16, it says the only reason why we, as humanity, know what love is because Jesus came and laid his life down for us. The only reason. If it wasn't for Jesus coming and laying his life down, we would never know what love is. Man. Dang. So then the next verse says, you know, that we are then invited to lay our lives down for one another. We can walk in the same footsteps that Jesus modeled for us. And not only passively sit by, but actively overcome love, even if it means potentially getting hurt again. Even if it means putting ourselves in harm's way and saying, you know what, I want to forgive you. Or will you forgive me? And then being rejected, saying, no, get out of here. I don't want to reconcile this. Putting yourself in that vulnerable situation, giving someone else who's already hurt you the power to hurt you again. Is it something that you think you could do? Is it something that would be worth it to you? If there's a possibility of full reconciliation, a full true peace on the other side. At the same time, I just want to add one small comment because, you know, in Bonella, we have a trauma counseling center for girls ages 5 to 15 who have been sexually abused many times by members of their own family, sometimes their own fathers. Stepfathers, uncles, brothers, you know, actually rape a girl that's 5, 6, 7 years old. And so they get reported to the police, and the police refer them to us, and we do trauma counseling with those girls. And so I felt like it was important to add this one note, that there are certain situations that just aren't healthy, and it's okay to leave them. Like if your boyfriend is beating you, if your father has raped you, it's okay to use wisdom and say, you know what, God can remove this bitterness from me, and I can forgive them, and I don't have to put myself in that harm's way again. Come on. It's okay for you to leave certain situations like that that are incredibly abusive and say, you know what, from a distance, I'll eagerly, actively desire peace. I'll desire true love. You know, to come into this situation, but God, I'm going to trust you that you're going to somehow make that a reality. And we see this with Joseph. I think Joseph did this on a regular basis. It's like, I don't exactly know how I can go and reach out to my brothers that sold me. They don't even know I'm alive. But he just was faithful in prayer. And God was like, you know what? I'm going to bring them to you. And I'm going to allow, you know, through my just incredible sovereignty, I'm going to allow reconciliation to come. Even though you technically didn't really actively pursue it, I brought it to you. And so sometimes there are situations like that. And we can trust God to do that. And that can also look like activity, right? To actively desire and actively pray for reconciliation without saying, here I am, you know, are you going to abuse me again? Or Sometimes we do need to use wisdom. Even when sending the girls home, every time we go and make sure to the best of our ability, the situation that they're returning to is safe and they're not going to get sexually abused again. And that's not, ignoring this teaching. That's not harboring resentment in our hearts or letting the girls harbor resentment in our hearts. And so, yeah, I just felt like I should add that. So I just want to end with some lyrics from a song. It's a song called 7 times 70 by a guy named Chris August. So you guys ready? It's like two verses in the chorus, so it's a little bit, that's not too long, but he just writes, he says, I've been living in this house since the day that I was born. These walls have seen me happy, but most of all, they've seen me torn. They've heard the screaming matches that made a family fall apart. They've had a front row seat to the breaking of my heart. I've lost count of the ways that you've let me down, but no matter how much you weren't around, I'm all right now. God picked up my heart and helped me through. He shined a light on the one thing left to do, and that is to forgive you. I forgive you. 7 times, 70 times, if that's the cost, I'll pay the price. I thought the pain was here to stay, but forgiveness made a way. Whew. 7 times, 70 times, there's healing in the air tonight. I'm reaching up to pull it down. I'm gonna wrap it all around. So definitely, just if you find resentment in your heart, plead with the Lord to give you wisdom and to help you find the strength to rid yourself of that resentment. He's so eager to help you, and he's so delighted to bring unity back into families.
Thanks for listening to the Flood Church Sermon Podcast. Please send us your feedback by commenting below or by emailing floodlilongwe@gmail.com.